Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here's your moderator, Mr. Raymond Ibrahim.
Thank you, Ellen, and welcome to everyone to another Middle East Forum conference call. Today we host Dr. Wafat Sultan, a clinical psychologist from Syria who first made major waves in 2006 when she delivered a very articulate attack on Islam on Arabic Al Jazeera satellite TV, and I recall watching it personally live, and that was very interesting and enlightening. To make a long story short about her, based on her activities, the Times eventually named her one of the most 100 important people in the world in 2006 due to her activist activities and writings. Yet her enemies, of course, have threatened her life and continue doing so to the point that she has been forced to live in hiding, where she joins us today for this conference call. Thank you for joining us, Wafat. Please tell us a little about your new book, A God Who Hates.
Thank you so much, Raymond. Thank you, everyone, for inviting me to this conference and giving me the opportunity to speak about my book. My book is simply my personal life story. The purpose of writing this book is to send a message to the West that it's time for people to wake up and realize the danger of Islam that threatens their way of life. Having born and raised as a Muslim has played a major role in shaping my convictions regarding Islam. I have reached a point where I am certain that man internalizes the God he worships and eventually becomes his God. If you dive deeply in the Islamic text, the Quran, and the biography of Muhammad, you will find countless actions and commands that are comparable to those of jihadists. In my book, A God Who Hates, I attempt to present the Muslim God similar to the way God was introduced to me growing up in Syria. He was intolerant, resentful, and angry entity driven by hate. A God who abhors women, who allows his followers to punch and even to behead non-Muslims, doesn't engender compassion or kindness. To me, the nature of this God is not at all that of a loving God. People always ask me what it has to be done. According to my book, A God Who Hates, the Islamic world needs urgent reforms with respect to three major areas. Islamic nations must grant their citizens the freedom of belief. They should be able to freely practice Islam or to freely reject it without the fear of being stoned or killed, because under Islamic Sharia, whoever left Islam is to be killed. Second, Islamic nations must grant their women equal rights as those granted to their men. Islamic nations must alter their school curriculums containing religious and civic education, which teach intolerance towards other religions and hatred toward Christians and Jews, even against other Islamic sects. That's what it needs to be done in the Islamic world to save our civilization in the West. I was born and raised as a Muslim in my country, Syria, and I lived for 3 decades of my life under Islamic Sharia. And I immigrated to the United States in 1989. And since then, I have been enjoying my freedom and fighting the teachings that I suffered because of for 3 decades of my life, trying to save other women who are going now through what I had gone when I lived in Syria. I believe the West for many, many, many centuries has ignored the women's status in the Islamic country and now is paying a high price for that, because a woman, an abused woman, cannot raise a well mentally and emotionally well balanced child. So in my book, I very much address the problem that women face in Islamic world, hoping one day the West will try to save those women and face the Islamic teachings. I believe the world's problem now is to find an effective way of dealing and communicating with Islam, and it must be based on honesty. We need to face Muslims with questions about their teachings and put pressure on them to come up with honest answers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Wafaa. I'd like to take some of the first, or offer one of the first questions and an observation. First, I completely agree with you about honesty when reaching out to the Islamic world instead of being placating or humoring, but being upfront about these doctrines. So I completely agree with you. But what I'd like to ask you first is, you discussed apostasy and how, according to Sharia, if you're an apostate, you
yes.
are to be killed, stoned. And you also discussed the status of females and all these things. And so ultimately what you are looking for, as well as everyone else, is how to reform Islam to get these elements out of it. But so to me, what I often see is, here's the conundrum, here's the confusion. How can, if one eliminates apostasy laws and if one makes, allows females to have the same status as males in Islam, you are ultimately overthrowing, you're ignoring Sharia law. You're basically
yeah.
saying no to it. Now, when you do that, are you not, in essence, saying no to Islam itself? In other words, once you do these reforms, are you not ultimately, you're not just throwing Sharia out the window, are you not also throwing out Islam? Because Islam and Sharia, in many ways, are one. So
absolutely.
I'd like to hear what you think.
Absolutely, you're right. I don't believe we can reform Islam. I really don't. Because once you try to reform it, you will finish it.
Right.
Because in order to be Muslim, you have to believe that the Quran is the absolute word of God, and you cannot change the meaning of its verses. So we cannot reform Islam, but what we can do is reform Muslims by facing them and asking about the nature of their, you know, teachings. Because I believe Muslims for 1400 years have been hostages of their own belief system. They have never been exposed to the external world. And now the internet is breaking the wall around the Islamic prison. So it is time. It is much easier now to do what we have to do. You cannot reform Islam, but you cannot educate people and in the Muslim world, I believe, and teach them, you know, what's wrong with their teachings.
Yes.
And you cannot, once you reject Islamic Sharia, you are rejecting the whole Islam, because you cannot separate. For Muslim, he's allowed only to live, to accept the Islamic law, the Sharia law. So I believe Muslims who are living in the West is because they don't have any choice. They don't believe in the American Constitution. And if they believe eventually they have to replace the American Constitution with the Islamic Sharia, this is the underlying foundation of Islam, is to control the world.
Okay. What if someone asks you, and I'd like to get your opinion, what do you think of moderate Islam and moderate Muslims? Do these words have any meaning to you, or
is this just a Western fabrication? Absolutely, there is no moderate Islam. There is moderate Muslims for one reason. Most Muslims don't know much about their Islam, and especially the non-Arab Muslims. You need to understand that Islam is a pure Arabic religion. And in order to fully understand Islam, you have to know how to read and write in Arabic. And that's why I always ask the American, the Western government is to translate the Islamic references from its Arabic sources and have people, you know, read about Islam and reach their own conclusion. There is no moderate Islam. But there are moderate Muslims because they don't know much about their Islam.
So basically the moderate Muslim is not much of a Muslim at all.
They're not at all. You cannot be moderate and Muslim at the same time. You in order to be true Muslim, you have to stick to the Islamic Sharia that was born in the 7th century.
Right. Okay, this is wonderful. Ellen, shall we start taking calls?
Thank you. To join the question and answer session queue, just press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. So once again, to join the question and answer session queue, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And we'll take our first question from the line of Mr. David Kudish. Go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you for your wonderful presentation. I've seen you in Chicago, and you were a guest of Camera in Chicago several times. There are people who claim, as you know, through their organizations like ISNA and others that are monitored by Dr. Pipes and by Stephen Emerson, the Investigative Project, that are really so-called false reformers. Then there are people like Ershan Manji, M. Mazudi Jasser, people like that who are of the style who really do care about reforming Islam. Can you draw a distinction between the so-called false reformers who get much too much publicity and recognition by the U.S. government and the individual unorganized efforts of real heroes?
I truly believe, I don't believe Islam can be reformed. But if there are others who claim they can do that, give them the time, and I hope one day they will prove me wrong. But personally, from my experience as an ex-Muslim woman, I don't see we can do that. As I said, in order to be a true Muslim, you have to believe in every single word Muhammad said or even the Quran mentioned. And you have to believe that the Quran is the absolute word of God, and you're not allowed to change the meaning or any word. So I don't know what they mean by reforming Islam. Personally, I don't believe they can do that. So I really don't know what are they going to do in order to reform Islam.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Mrs. Marilyn Stern. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, hi, Dr. Sultan.
Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm hearing you speak, and as a person who is in the psychological field, you are basically expecting Muslims who are culturally and historically committed to their communities to have an ultimatum. Won't this have a backlash? It'll turn off more than not?
I didn't understand your question.
Do you feel that if Americans in the West begin putting pressure on Muslims, that will cause Muslims and Muslim countries to become even worse and maybe more violent?
I believe even if it could be a transition period of time, they have to become more violent, yes. But eventually, they have to face, you know, the cruelty of their teachings. They might become more violent, but who cares? If we keep putting pressure, at the end, they have to accept the reality, and they have to face the reality. And I do believe we have to put pressure on the Muslim governments to do something about it.
But the
being afraid of pushing Muslim to become more violent doesn't serve us any favor. We have to do it. It's time to do it.
I'm sorry if I may add to that. But the Muslims that live in America, the ones who are who are not perhaps as educated in the tenets you're talking about.
Yes.
But they are very culturally committed to their communities and to their history. And I would think it would be a natural reaction to be defensive about those positive aspects that are the cultural parts of their lives and to reject offhand what you're saying.
Yeah, I believe Muslims in the West are enjoying fully the Western life, and they don't feel the pressure to make any change. This is the problem with Muslims in the West. They are playing two games, one with the West and one the other game with their people in the Islamic country, convincing them that they are defending Islam here in the West, but they are enjoying every aspect of Western life. They're very confused between the rights they are enjoying here in America or in any other country in the West and their rights under Islamic Sharia. We have to face them. This is my opinion. The more we postpone the process of putting pressure on them, the more, the worse the issue will become. I agree with you. They might, out of trying to defend themselves, be more violent, but what can we do?
So are you saying that this is a potential, really, I'm taking this to an extreme, but are you saying there is a potential...
I know for someone like you who was born and raised by the American moral code, hard to understand what I am saying. And I believe I always say for someone who was born and raised in this country to understand my viewpoint, has to be a woman who lived for 30 years under Islamic Sharia. Because I am speaking out of my suffering. I suffered, and I believe I have the right to ask about the validity of Islamic teachings. And I know for sure I can, I'm witnessing the suffer that women in the Islamic world are going through. So from my own experience, I feel there is no choice but to face Muslims with the cruelty of their religion.
Then the final question, why is it, do you feel, that moderate Muslim women in the West are not stepping forward in greater numbers to take up the cause of their fellow Muslim women who are blatantly suffering? Why are they silent?
Why? Let me tell you from my own experience. it is almost impossible for someone to go against her own religion and her own culture. It is very draining and exhausting mission, and sometimes I understand their attitudes, because sometimes I reach a point I wish I didn't speak up against Islam, because my life is threatened every single day. As a mother, can you know, every day I receive emails telling me what we know, what schools your children go to, wait and see. This pressure, I believe, no human being can bear. It is a very tough mission to go against it. I can tell you that from my own experience. And I receive many emails from Muslim women who live in America telling me, you are the only hope we have. We cannot do what you are doing. And I agree. To some point, I agree with them. It is very tough. We are not protected. I am not protected. I have to hide myself. I have to take measures on my, you know, by myself, without any help of the government or any other people. It's not easy. It's not easy. I agree with them not to speak up. Sometimes I feel like it was a big mistake, even though I am enjoying the life of my choice. But it's very, very unbearable life.
Thank you, Dr. Sultan. You're an inspiration to us. We really admire your courage.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Mr. Frank Hoover. Go ahead with your question, please.
I appreciate the opportunity to throw a question that I think is of a nature that is fundamental to solving our dilemmas here, and it is this. We claim that there is one God, that the God of Abraham, Jacob, Ishmael, Muhammad, etc., is the God. There is only one. What do you think of the notion that wherever people have set forth and proclaimed the word of God, be it Allah or be it the God of the Jews or the Christians, that wherever what they are claiming comes from their God, who is the same God all around, if it differs from one school or religion to the other, at least one of the opinions or the dogma are wrong. If they agree, they may both be right or they may both be wrong. But I think that it will be only when we see the Islam, the Muslim, and the Christian and the Jewish philosophers, is what I will call them now, who have discussed the differences and the validity of various texts that have been brought out, that we can get anywhere, because in those kinds of discussions, no one party can possibly be right all the time. We have to be more humble, each in our own faith, and recognize that the word of our God has come to each of us through the mind and lips of men and women. It is hearsay. Muhammad, Jesus, Peter, Paul, the prophets of the Old Testament were human beings, and there is always room for misinterpretation or different interpretation. We have to get those things out to discuss them in a non-threatening way. Now, my question is this at all feasible, or is it is it dead on arrival?
I think the question basically, what is the viability of interfaith dialogue with Islam?
You know what? I don't know much about other religions like Christianity or Judaism, but I truly believe if God exists, he's absolutely not the Muslim God. Because as I said earlier, a God who abhors women, who allow his followers to punch and even to behead non-Muslims, is not the true God. Regarding the interfaith dialogue, you can, you know, go ahead and do it if you can negotiate with the Muslims. But you are, I don't know if they're going to change their minds. They believe their God is the right God. So I really don't know. From my experience as an ex-Muslim, they look at your attempt to negotiate with them or to discuss with them as a sign of weakness, because they know you cannot change them. It is a matter of wasting time, I truly believe.
I can understand why you feel that way, but if and since there is only one God, wherever the beliefs that people have attributed to God are opposing, the notion of who brought the message to us as being infallible is subject to scrutiny and denial. That is the new hope that I hope we can make use of in order to challenge each faith to re-examine the doctrine which has come to them, since it's all hearsay and through the mind of man and women. It's certainly not unsacrilegious to have that sort of a notion once you realize that we will never know God, nobody's ever seen him, etc., 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 and the stories that of what a particular man says God is telling him has to pass through the mind of that particular man and may be faulty.
Thank you, Mr. Hoover. Ellen, how much time is left?
We still have a minute or two.
Okay. Any more short, brief questions?
We'll take our next question from the line of Mr. Larry Gold. Mm-hmm. Go ahead with your question, please.
Wafa, I think you deserve the Nobel Prize much more than Obama.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry. I love you.
With that preface, what can Americans do to influence their government? And this Clinton failed, Bush failed, and Obama's failing, and also the press, to open their eyes to the problems of dealing with the Islamic threat to our nation.
Get involved. Don't be only observer, and put more pressure on your government to find an effective way of dealing and communicating with Islam. And as I said, it must be based of honesty. The politically correctness is not going to do any favor for you. You have to be bold and face the Islamic teachings and the Islamic Sharia here in America. You know what? I want, and my dream is one day to see my native country, Syria, as a free country, as the United States is. I don't want to see my adopted country as oppressive as Syria is. And that's why I am fighting and risking my life is to save the beautiful country that granted me my rights to live as a human being. And I want everybody here not to take his life for granted and to fight to protect his way of life and his freedoms, his human rights. We have to do it. At any prices, we have to do it.
Okay, thank you very much, Wafat, for sharing with us your time and thoughts, the latter being very inspiring. As I always say, I think it's always useful for Westerners to listen to someone like you who not only brings theoretical knowledge but actual experience, you being a Muslim woman who was born and lived in the Middle East, of all people, would of course know the situation on the ground. So once again, thank you very much for joining us for this conference call.
Thank you for everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we have one final question from the line of Mr. Philip Feist. Go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you, Doctor. This is Philip Feist, and I would say that you're one of our national treasures from what I've heard today.
Thank you.
And the question I would ask you is, with Islam being what it is, I do not understand, and maybe you can help me understand, how especially Muslim women would encourage their children, for instance, to become suicide bombers. It just appears to me from what I see, and perhaps this is our press, that there is a lot of support for the oppressions within the Muslim world by the women themselves.
It is the power of brainwashing at early age. I was raised to believe my purpose on life is to fight for the sake of Allah and to kill or to be killed in this fight. Once you brainwash little kids, they fell to this trap. They cannot get out of it. This woman has been deprived of her motherhood, has been deprived of her humanity by her Islamic teachings. You know, you are who you were convinced you were at the throughout your first 10 years. You cannot, it's almost impossible for someone to change his beliefs after a certain time. So I believe Muslims fell into this trap that their purpose on earth is to fight for the sake of Allah. It is well written in our Quran. It is our mission on this earth. And we were brainwashed to believe in it. So it's the power of brainwashing at very early age.
That's a powerful statement. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us, Wafat.
Thank you, Rima.